Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black arts and culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. We are going to be bringing you an interview with Antoine Hunter, the brains behind the second annual Deaf Dance Festival this weekend. However, I need to do a little technical backstage work right at the moment. So we're going to bring you an interview with Lacey Swartz, director of Little White Lie, a film that's had its world premiere this past Sunday and is continuing to be screened as a part of the San Francisco Jewish Film Festival number 34. And so she's got a screening tomorrow, Thursday, August 7th, at the Parkway in Oakland. Should be really fun. And then at the Raphael on Saturday, August 9th in San Rafael. So anyway, tune in, and we're going to play that interview with Lacey. We're going to play the interview with Lacey after a little musical interlude with Damu Sudi Ali's Feeling My Way. And you can catch Damu performing with Paul Hillman Smith on drums. Both of them are a part of the Bay Area Jazz organization, maybe? I'm not certain exactly. Let me see. Bay Area Jazz Society. Sorry. And they're hosting a series of wonderful jazz jams featuring both of them, Paul Tillman Smith on drums and Damu Sudi Ali on piano. So on Sundays, Damu hosts, and on Thursday, Paul Tillman Smith hosts. And there are two different restaurants, the Southern Cafe, Soul Food Buffet on Sundays. That's at 2000 MacArthur Boulevard. And that jam session is from 5 to 8. And then the other jam session with Paul is at the Kingston Cafe over on, I believe it's on Telegraph in Oakland. So that should be really fun. I haven't made it out to one yet, but I know both of the musicians in there. Certainly high caliber. And each venue has its own set of special guests. Sometimes they have vocalists, and they have, and with Sudi, he has Carl Lockett on guitar and Alex Smith on bass, but sometimes that also varies. I wish I could give you some contact information, but I'm not seeing any on the flyer right now, so you might just have to just pop on in and just check it out. So here is something from Damu, and it's called Feeling My Way.
Night, the time is right for love, but you're not there beside me. So I'm just feeling my way. Jump out of bed, I take a stroll, if I can just control this fire that burns in my soul. Lord, help me make it through a brand new day. The stars of night shining bright, my heart was pining for you. Space and time, someday your love I'll find. Someday we're gonna meet, then my life will be complete. Until that lucky day, I'll pass the time away with you in my imagination, 'cause you're always on my mind. Up in the morning, oh, my job is getting hard to live without. Something tell me your good love I've got to find. Ladies up and down the street, looking so fine, so sweet. I look for your face everywhere. Where can you be? Ooh, baby, come home to me. I know you're out there somewhere. So let's begin this.
Sudiali composition. And again, you can catch the Sunday Jazz Jam at Southern Cafe with Damu every Sunday, 5 to 8 in Oakland at 2000 MacArthur Boulevard. Hear some great music. And if you are a skilled musician or a singer, you can definitely bring some sheet music and sit in. And others can just enjoy the music. And good food. And I will give you the details on the other jazz jam, because I'm like not quite certain what the day is and what the time is. I just know the restaurant is the Kingston Cafe, and I hear the food is wonderful in both places. And these musical offerings free to the community are a part of the Bay Area Jazz Society under the guidance of Paul Tillman Smith, drummer, and arranger and composer extraordinaire. Alrighty, so now we're going to talk a little bit about Lacey Schwartz and her film Little White Lie. I wrote a little something, and I'm going to read what I wrote about it, and then we're going to jump right into the interview. Who would have known is the title of this. Schwartz means black. It is one thing when there is racial ambiguity based on systemic commodification of one's people. It's another when the questions stem from an omission or purposeful lie, which is the case when little Lacey Schwartz was born. Lacey, who was accepted into the Klan, notices as did others, her darker skin and curly hair, yet said nothing. Perhaps upper-class Woodstock, New York, where she was born, is a town without many black people. Certainly the childhood photos in her film, Little White Lie, 2014, did not show any students in grammar school with Lacey who are unquestionably black, nor do we see Jews with African ancestry at her family synagogue. Hers was the tight, close-knit community, which can be a blessing. In this case, it was, because though different, no one seemed to stigmatize the young girl for her darker skin or complexion. Yet Lacey knew she was missing a part of the story. How come she didn't look like both parents, cousins or aunts? The Sicilian grandfather explanation for her skipping generations of pigment just didn't feel right the older she got. The questioning glances didn't help either, especially when her mom and dad divorced. Was she the cause? When Georgetown University accepted her application for admission, then had the audacity to call her African-American when she left the racial identification box unchecked, yet included the prerequisite photo, suddenly someone disconnected emotionally from the stigma or shame silently attached to Lacey's birth. Name the elephant sitting in the room all her life. Georgetown helped coach the elephant out of the house onto the field where it gave Lacey room to hose it down. The stench was pretty awful. Lies are like that. Clearly Lacey was onto something she had to pursue, and she immediately joined the Black Student Association. The omissions, who was she? Loomed like huge craters in her 18-year existence. She stepped gingerly on the debris-covered surface, careful not to fall as she led two lives, one at school and another in Woodstock. If her parents noticed her changing, neither said anything to her about it. It was as if she had really come home once she got away. Her brown skin now had social and political context. Unable to claim all of herself for 18 years, Lacey had a lot of catching up to do then. Now post-film, after academic life, after marriage, now that she is CEO of Truth Aid Media and interested in helping others uncover their secrets or lies, one could say the split is less apparent. Lacey now occupies both sides of the room. She has worlds about equal time, so perhaps she has finally caught up with herself. However, when asked, says the process of healing and forgiveness might take a lifetime. One wonders in Little White Lies, the word white is highlighted in the color to emphasize the literal coloring or racializing of the word. Was the notion of blackness ignored or omitted because whiteness was preferable to blackness? That typically white people do not talk about race certainly played a role in Lacey's acceptance in Woodstock. But at Georgetown University, then later at Harvard, where the director got a law degree, Lacey's evolving discovery of self and other aspects of her personal history and culture continued to be challenged as she embraced all of herself, even if the parts sometimes were at war. In an interview, the director says that she was able to make the journey because she had such a good therapist whom we meet vicariously in multiple sessions where a sometimes tearful Lacey on film shares what she is feeling as her carefully constructed world comes tumbling down. James McBride, the writer, his mother tells him when he asked about his skin color and how his is different than his mother, that he is the color of water, God's color. In the film Skin, directed by Anthony Fabian, a South African family whose daughter, Sandra Liang, is clearly black. Her father has her classified as white because both he and her mother are. However, the child learns painfully that judicial mandates do not always win out over appearances when she is kicked out of school and her father disowns her when she marries a black man. The young woman has to leave home and family when her brother, father, and community turn against her. Unlike Lacey's story, this black woman, who was raised in anti-apartheid South Africa, finds herself between two poles accepted by neither. Limbo is a dangerous place to occupy. Even though race technically is an artificial construct, so much of American life, including post-apartheid South African public policy, is still based on pigment or melanin content. If Lacey had been able to pass for white, she would have never known she had another father, and the little white lie would have remained under wraps until perhaps a stray gene like a free radical, the kind Woodstock was known for, remember, a la Eddie Hendrix, peeked its head across generations in recognition of the complexities of relationships, who we marry, who we are, who we decide is worthy, and who we disregard or pass over, and the consequences of all of this, a la Lacey. Late in the film, Lacey, in many conversations with her mother, who tells the lie, learns that her mother would not have married her biological father even if she could have, because her dad, who raised her, in her view, her mom's view, was the better catch. Yet we hear her mother's hesitation, that she couldn't see herself marrying a black man then. It just wasn't done. Lacey's biological father's wife knew about the affair and his child, yet neither Lacey nor her dad did. I don't know what Jews do to repent, but Lacey's mother has a lot of repenting to do. Maybe these years of silence were the purgatory this film allows her to wash with truth. And again, the film is screening tomorrow at the Parkway in Oakland at 7 p.m. and Friday, August 8th, at the Raphael in San Rafael at 3 p.m. And you can visit the Little White Lie, thefilm.com for more information, or call 415-671-0523. So here is the interview with Lacey, recorded last week. Wow, Lacey, your story is unbelievable, literally.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, and your investigative work is certainly admirable, because I believe you're actually in. Are you an attorney?
I am. I went to law school.
Okay, you went to law school.
I never actually practiced, but I am an attorney. I took the bar.
Right. Yeah, and your father, he's an attorney, right?
He's not, actually.
He's not? Oh, I thought that's what I saw on the thing. Anyway,
I was thinking.
Sort of where your investigative journalism kind of skills come from, because, wow, I mean, you really had to uncover a lot to be able to get to the story of who you are, and that's what Little White Lie is about identity and how one lie can really warp sort of disrupt, in really unbelievable ways, sort of family and family structures, almost irreparably.
Yes. No, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that, I don't know if I would say irreparably. Like, I really do believe that if you are able to have those conversations, it can actually be really productive and it can be really redemptive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I said almost. Not
okay.
No, almost.
Yeah.
And it's
yeah.
in the almost, sort of like the caveat, because you did have those conversations, the relationships were able to be repaired, and it seems like it's an ongoing process, actually.
Absolutely. No, it's definitely an ongoing process. Although I do think that, like, once you have the conversations, it really does help, you know, bring you to the next level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But to have conversations, you know, where there've been, you know, lies, you know, sort of, how do you establish the trust, the ground for people to be vulnerable, to be able to mm-hmm. step out there, particularly, you know, your dad, who was not, he seemed like the last person to find out about, you know, who your biological, that your biological father was not him, and sort of, you know, sort of what was happening with the marriage between your father and your mother. But maybe we should back up a little bit and and maybe sort of, you know, tell our audience sort of what's the story about and how you were so brave to decide to you want to know, because you could have just, you know, sort of stayed, you know, in the dark, literally, and just sort of accepted things the way they were, but you wanted to know. And so began this journey that turned into this great film. And I don't know, is that sort of, you have your CEO of Truth Aid, and I'm wondering, was Truth Aid a result of this journey that you take us on?
I mean, absolutely. I think Truth Aid, actually, interestingly enough, my business partner, myself, Marette Mendezo, we were both kind of individuals working on projects and realized that they were very different projects at the time, but they had a lot of the same kind of threads through them, not necessarily in terms of the actual narrative, the actual story, mm-hmm. but in terms of the larger concepts and the way we were looking at issues. I mean, we say that part Truth Aid, we look at barriers to well-being, social barriers to well-being, and kind of what are those, and that can be anything from like race, health issues. It can be really, really broad, but there's still like this through line of like this kind of concept of what are we not talking about and what is not being dealt with in an open, healthy manner. And so we interpret it, as I said, really broadly, but it is still nonetheless really, really important to look at. So Truth Aid was kind of inspired by working on this and other projects as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you're also direct producer and outreach strategist who has worked with a variety of production companies, organizations, and networks, including MTV, BET, Ad Radical, .media, NASCAR, and Bachol Lachon. Is that how you pronounce that?
Bachol Lachon.
Okay. And
which is a Jewish organization that works around racial and ethnic diversity in the Jewish community.
Okay, right. And you're a Jewish too, right?
I am, yeah.
Mm-hmm, yeah. And you're also executive produced the narrative film, is it Different?
Yes, exactly.
Different. Yeah, which won audience awards at the 2014 Sundance and Berlin Film Festivals. And you have a BA from Georgetown University and a JD from Harvard Law School. And you're a member of the NYS Bar, I guess New York State Bar. And so it's really interesting how the journey, according to the film, sort of formally began at Georgetown, you know, when you sort of took on another identity, not as, because you, before the Georgetown, you were a white girl. And then when you went to Georgetown, you was like, oh, you know, you took on the narrative and the cultural life of a black woman. And so tell our audience a little bit about the film, like give us sort of like the synopsis and then we can talk more about it.
Yeah, the film is a personal documentary called Little White Lie about dual identity and family secrets. It follows kind of my journey growing up in a white Jewish family and discovering that my background is different than I thought it was. And it's really about how do you learn to uncover family secrets and learn to live with a dual identity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's, you know, when we think about dual identities, you know, ones that are conscious and ones that are less readily accessible. You know, W.E.B. Du Bois is sort of in, you know, the whole idea of two-ness and how, you know, one sees that playing out, you know, in the mm-hmm. film is an externalization almost of that. And, you know, we think about all the different landmark legislative decisions and landmark protests and movements that are happening right now when your film is coming out. You know, we think about the 50th anniversary of Freedom Summer, you know, this summer, and we think about the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act, and last year and the year before, we've got the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, and, you know, and then I think next year there's another landmark legislative piece having its big anniversary, and then we have your film, you know, which sort of looks at how, you know, one little white lie, and the white is sort of a play on the you know, it's got a nuanced meaning, can you know, sort of really impact a life in ways that one probably can't even project, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I really appreciate the context you just put it in. I mean, obviously, because those are very important and historical events, and I think that this film is a super personal story, but what our goal with it is really to look at it and look at some of these issues that still, you know, times have certainly changed, but there's still a lot of issues around race in general, but in particular in the United States. And this kind of question of how are we talking about it, how are we dealing with it, what can we do about it, and when I really was, it's a topic I think a lot about, and when I was thinking about, you know, how could I kind of add to the conversation, really what I realized is that the issue of the fact that we're not even having these conversations within our own family is a huge problem. And I really look at families are the building blocks of society. So we can't just have these conversations on some larger societal level and say, you know, what's going on? Society, why are we still having these problems? We really need to be willing to look within, you know, the core of our society, which is our families, and wonder and talk about it there as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I just thought, wow, you videotaped your sessions with your therapist. I'm like, oh my goodness, like,
yes,
really? Yeah. My therapist wouldn't even let me tape it, audio tape it. I'm like, yours, let you videotape yours. And I'm like, did you, because you didn't even know at that point that you were going to make a film, right?
No, I mean, you know, I was filming a lot of stuff. I obviously filmed a lot of stuff over time, and that was something that I knew I wanted to do, was film. I mean, I filmed a lot over time.
Okay.
And so I really wanted to make sure that I captured things. That was one of the things that I really wanted to work with a therapist who would let me film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're right, not all therapists would let you do that, but I worked with a therapist who respected that process.
Mm-hmm.
And was really open to it. You know, and it's funny because people ask me that about a therapy, but you'd be surprised when it's just, I mean, really, that was just a camera on a tripod. It wasn't a camera person in the room.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very easy to forget that camera is just sitting in the corner.
Mm. Yeah, but just to be so vulnerable, I mean, that's one thing about this film. It's like you're extremely vulnerable. You just put it all out there, you know, from the baby, you know, when you're in the nursery in the hospital, you know, and everybody's looking through the window, you know, to as you're growing up and looking a bit different from your cousins, but, you know, hey, you take after Sicilian relative, right? And, like, and that's where the color comes from. And and not really thinking about it that much. And then you have the Georgetown awakening. talk about sort of, having curly hair and you know, looking different from the kids in the classroom, but yet not necessarily experiencing a difference per se. I'm sure you probably dated and all that. Was it because where you lived in New York? Was it because of that? Sort of how did you have this really different, isolated kind of experience where you were white, but not white, yet we're not scarred, let's say, from that particular experience the way perhaps other children might have been, if there would have been more focus on, you know, skin color. Was it the love that your family felt for you? Was it because they wanted to believe the lie? What was it? What was going on?
Sorry, help me understand. What's the question?
The question is how did you, you know, in your film, you know, you show us, you know, before, like when you were growing up, you saw yourself as a white girl, like, you know, everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you, you know, you lived in a place in New York that was wasn't necessarily that diverse. So, so I was just wondering, you know, maybe you could talk about, in retrospect, sort of looking at yourself then and then yourself when you were at Georgetown, because in the film that's like a, that's a definitely, that's a shift in consciousness.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that for me, it was definitely gradual, and that's something that I try to represent in the film, and it wasn't like less about kind of having this big aha moment.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something that I really, you know, I spent a lot of time obviously thinking about this and analyzing it and recognizing that it wasn't this aha moment. It wasn't just this one thing where all of a sudden it just made me click and say, oh, this is the truth. You know, it was kind of over time. And, I, you know, it's also in this way in which, as we all know, like, race is really a social construction, right? And so it's not like this firm thing like you're in or you're out, but it actually is, can be a lot more, the lines can be much more fuzzy of when you're feeling included and when you're not. And I think that when I really went back and really tried to figure out what I was experiencing when I went away to Georgetown, because it's not that I just go away to Georgetown and I immediately just say I'm black because I don't have any real connection to it, but it's more about the idea that I can start exploring what that means for me, because I'm questioning a lot of things, and I do have obviously reason at that point to question what's going on, but I don't have any answers. So it's not like this really firm moment. It's something that's a little bit more gradual, and I think that a lot of things in life are like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. Yeah, I was thinking in a similar way. You probably know the director Katrina Brown and her film Traces of the Trade, which looks at the DeWitt family and their involvement in the slave trade, and you know they were like, were really big, and she talks about how everything was sort of hidden in plain sight, and she also went on like an excavation kind of journey to understand her family's role in this, because it was something they didn't speak about. And I was wondering if you could talk about, because you had these wonderful anchors, and there was a lot of love, there's a lot of love in the film for you, which I think is really helpful in making this trek. Because if you weren't being held like you were being held, you know, sort of emotionally and philosophically by your family, your cousins, and your grandparents, and your aunts and uncles, and then your friends, you know, at, you know, in your hometown, as well as, you know, when you go, you know, go to Georgetown, et cetera. I don't think you would have been able to do it as, I mean, it was painful, it seems, you know, at certain junctures, because you had to literally pull certain things out of people to get at the truth of it. But I don't know, it's just sort of like, it just seemed like you were blessed with a certain type of ground that you could do this kind of exploration, which I think speaks a lot to the people that bore you and raised you.
Absolutely. It speaks a ton to them, and I'll forever be, you know, I mean, they're my family, and I love them dearly, but I'm very grateful for that as well. I can't agree with, you know, more with what you just said.
Mm-hmm.
I totally agree that kind of support, you know, and I think that's part of the lesson in it, right, is that, like, we're not perfect. Nobody's perfect. Like, people made mistakes. My mother made mistakes, but that doesn't mean, that in and of itself is not, like, kind of fatalistic to a relationship. That life is complicated and people do make mistakes, but there's still love and there's still, in the end, really, the people are really out there and will be there for you. And I think that is very important to me. That I don't look at anyone, my family, including myself, as perfect in any way. But that we are very dedicated to each other, and that is really what matters the most.
So, could you talk about sort of the difficulties you had with getting the truth, you know, about, because, you know, you didn't know the truth because, you know, you were a child, you're a baby, so you had to get people to tell you, and it seemed like it was really difficult. People didn't seem to want to go back there, go there with you, your mother specifically, or your father, raised you, and I was wondering if you could talk about sort of how you were able to pursue this, even when you ran into resistance. Like, how did you keep on going? And then maybe you could talk about some of the affirmations that came from that, immediate and long term, around identity and personhood that you hold now.
Yeah, and you're talking about specifically in a personal way, not in terms of making a film, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, first off, I had a really, really good therapist who really helped me understand that living authentically was the most important thing. I think that there's a way in which people, I shouldn't speak to other people, that I was at times trying to, at a certain point, like, I almost became the protector of my own secret, because I really felt like I had a real interest in making sure my life stayed the same. You know, change can be very, very, very hard. And so even if something isn't ideal, sometimes I think people just resist change. So they just want to stay with the status quo. And that was something that, in certain ways, I had really fallen into that rut. And I think that working with somebody to help me understand that actually living my, like, kind of authentic self, it wasn't about, it gets to a certain point where it's not about whether or not, you know, analyzing what will be the outcomes, what is the, you know, kind of pros and cons of doing something, but actually realizing that that is kind of who you authentically are, and that is your truth, and it's such a cliche, but literally, like, the truth will set you free. But it is worth any consequences you may have. I mean, a lot of times what I've come to also realize is that the consequences seem so much grander in your head. You know, if you have a conversation, it seems like, oh, my God, like the sky will fall down. But a lot of times it's actually fine. You know, the conversation, although it can be difficult and it can be emotional, that you will then get up and walk away from it, and you will be okay. And so that idea that, you know, the actual unspoken things were much more powerful and had a lot more control over me than actually just having the conversation and letting myself be free of it was something that I really work with somebody to realize and come to terms with and then be very dedicated to. So even at times when I just felt, you know, we're all going about our day-to-day lives, and it's very easy to avoid having these conversations because, you know, you're worried about groceries and going to work and, you know, friends' birthday parties or whatever, you know, your kids, whatever it is. And then there's real things, too, like, you know, obviously physical health issues and things like that. But it's very easy to kind of avoid all that and just get up every day and go through your day and go to sleep and not really move some of these things forward. But it was getting to the point where I realized that I was actually had something to lose from continuing on as I had.
Yeah. And I was just looking at your production team. It's just like, oh, my goodness, Sam Pollard, creative advisor, Stanley Nelson, creative advisor, you've got Michelle Ferrari, senior creative advisor, and then you've got the composer, Catherine Bostick, and your editor, and it's like, oh, my, you've got like a dream team. Your cinematographer, James Adolphus, is phenomenal, and co-director, and then you've got McReed, Madefro, producer and co-writer, and then yourself, you know, director, producer, and writer. It's like, oh, my, how did you pull together this fabulous team?
Yeah. I mean, part of that was, I mean, yeah. I'm like, beyond thankful to those people because I never, ever, ever could have done this project, like, completely by myself. I mean, I think part of it was just, you know, my grandmother always used to say it's all about connections, 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 mm-hmm. you know, and just really being diligent about the project, believing in it, talking to people and really respecting what they could do. And I think sometimes being able to really ask for help and knowing that I needed help and knowing that it wasn't just about my ideas alone, but that I really needed, I mean, as you said, these are incredible people who I really, really admire, and I really wanted their input and their support in the project. So I think they were drawn to the story, and I was really drawn to them and their talent, and it really worked out. I mean, some of these people, like, you know, Michelle Ferrari is a perfect example of somebody who I waited years to be able to work with her because she was a really busy schedule, and I would just kind of follow up with her at different periods of time to make sure that she to check in to see if she had any time and she could work with me. So it was part of patience as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. So how's your relationship with your parents? And then I have a question about family after that.
Absolutely. My relationship with my parents is good. It's, you know, as many people's relationship with their parents, it has its ups and downs at various moments, but I feel very supported and loved by them.
Yeah, I like the part in the film when your father, you all have that last conversation. That's really, really, yeah, it's great. People will see what I mean when they see the film.
We're all a work in progress, and I think that that was one of the things that I, you know, when I went into making this film, I thought, oh, I wanted to, like, wrap it up with a nice bow, and I don't think that life is really about that, but it doesn't mean that you still don't make progress.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, that's definitely visible, you know, sort of everything is in process in the film, including yourself. I mean, the end is really not the end. It's the beginning. And it's a real happy in beginning, too, which is a great way to conclude the film. And then I was wondering sort of how, my last question is sort of how you would, you know, who is your family? Because, you know, family is part biological, but then it seems it's more the people who love you, who raise you, who teach you about values and sort of help shape you into the kind of citizen that of the world, that of the country, of the world, of the community that is having a positive impact. So, you know, some of that might be genetic, but sometimes you can't necessarily put your finger on that because you don't necessarily, you might not know, you know, whose genes are doing what. But you can point to the lessons because they are embodied in a person. Grandmother, as you mentioned earlier, you know, grandfather, uncle, aunt, cousin, et cetera.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I grew up in a kind of a close nuclear family, but also a close extended family.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still very close to my family that I grew up with. You know, I mean, I think part of it is, especially when you, as you said, it kind of relates to the production team question, is when you do a project like this, and it's just, like, so personal. So the people that, like, work with me, they, you know, sometimes it was really hard to distinguish between what was work and what was personal at various times. So, I mean, I just had such an incredible support system. I've been working on this project for a long time. So a lot of, like, advisors and friends who I wouldn't be who I was without them. You know, really, in a sense, as you said earlier, like, this journey started well before, but in a lot of ways it started when I went away to school with, like, professors who taught me how to think about things and question things, and that was all very much part of that process.
But you mentioned in the film that, you know, when you found out who your biological father was, you knew him before, right? And it didn't really click, you know, because he wasn't the father that raised you. And then you also, you know, had family on his side of the family. You know, you have siblings. And so he's wondering sort of, and then you have the family that you called family all along. I was just wondering, did any of that shift, like, do you have a relationship with your biological father's family now, or now that you all know each other, or did your family expand or anything?
I would say, honestly, I've since gotten married, so certainly my family expanded in that way. I would say, you know, with my biological father's family, generally, not largely. You know, there are people in his family that I do have a relationship with. And, I mean, in general, I value them. I think this, you know, part of his geography, and we're just not in each other's lives that much. There are some members of the family that I, you know, one of my sisters is in the film, and we do have a relationship. So it's kind of, I mean, not largely, but, you know, we'll see over time also, I think.
Well, since you mentioned that you're married, I just want to say that it's great, you know, that your marriage, you know, your wedding ceremony is in the film. It's just so fun. It's just really, really fun. It's just a great way, you know, because in the beginning, you know, births, you know, like there's a baby born, you know, there's a wedding in the beginning and there's a wedding in the end. So that's great the way you sort of like the end marks, you know, like these two celebrations of people coming together, you know, families coming together and creating community together. The bookends, I'm sure that was intentional, right?
Yeah. I mean, everything. You make a film over time, trust me, like everything in the end becomes very intentional.
Right, yeah. And so do you feel that as a person that you're enlarged now that you've, not enlarged, but I guess, I don't know, more fully who you are now that you know, now that there are the secrets that have been revealed?
Definitely. I mean, just this idea, I mean, I lived my life for many years in what I consider to be a racial closet. And this idea of trying to kind of keep track of who knew what and who I could be in any space. I mean, I do a lot of work around diversity and acceptance and just this idea that we can walk into any room and be who we are 100%, you know, the whole of who we are, not, okay, I can be this person in this space and that person in another space, but really just be who you are and not try to be something different depending on who you're around, mm-hmm. is something that I have worked on achieving, and I feel like I have, and it's very, very liberating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, congratulations on this wonderful film. Yeah, and, you know, this world premiere on Sunday at the Castros, and you're going to be there 7 to 11, safe travels on the way here.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, and then are you going to stick around for the screening on the 4th, Monday at 6:40?
Yes, I'm going to be there for the screening in Berkeley on Monday, and then I think we have another screening then the following Thursday, I believe it's the 7th.
Okay, good. Okay.
And then another one as well. All information on our screenings and just in general can be found on littlewhitelythefilm.com. We have a full list of screenings and all sorts of updates, so please, you know, people can also go online to share their own little white lies as well,
mm-hmm.
which we really want to make sure that people understand that this is not just about my story, but really about gathering and supporting people and telling their own and freeing themselves from their own secrets. So please visit the website, sign up, and get involved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yes. You know, your story is a great great example of why there shouldn't be secrets between loved ones.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
well, thank you so much.
Yeah, well, thank you for the wonderful conversation, and look forward to meeting you at one of these screenings.
Absolutely. Thanks again.
All right, you take good care.
You too.
Bye-bye. Bye.
One more time. Troubled mind.
almost lost my mind. I've never seen so much trouble in my life before. Now I'm gonna lay, I'm gonna lay my head on some lonesome railroad line. I'm gonna let the 219 train ease my troubled mind. Yes, trouble in mind, I'm blue, but I won't be blue always. You know the sun's gonna shine in my back door someday. You know the sun's gonna shine in my back door someday. You know that the sun's gonna shine in my back door someday.
That was Kim Nally singing Trouble in Mind, and wanted to let everyone know who wasn't able to make it to the celebration of the life of Yuri Koshiyama, who was born May 19, 1921, and made her transition shortly thereafter, June 1st, 2014. She was 93. It was really wonderful, and the whole... I guess, thrust of the memorial and that weekend, last weekend, you know, ending this Sunday, was around passing it on and passing on the legacy. And I just wanted to just sort of recall Yuri's work as an activist and as a friend of the liberation movement, that today is the anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima by the United States government. And Yuri was Japanese-American. And as we so reflect on this anniversary, we also want to also look at all of the other wars that we are still participating in as a nation. Most paramount in people's minds is the one happening currently in Gaza, where Israel is bombing the Palestinians. So just wanted to just drop that out there. And I'm going to play. I'm still trying to get it together, Antoine. It's going to happen, hopefully sooner than later. Oh, yeah, I think it is going to happen sooner than later. So I'm going to play Kim Nally's I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free. But before I do that, let me just tell you a little bit about Antoine Hunter, who is just a phenomenal brother. He's done so much. His legacy is sort of unparalleled. He's an African-American deaf and hard of hearing choreographer. He's a dancer, dance instructor, model, actor, and poet. And he was born deaf and was raised in Oakland, California, began dancing with Don James at Skyline High School. He studied West African dance with master teacher C.K. Lazekpo and Betty Lazekpo. He studied at the Paul Taylor Summer Intensives in 2003 and 2004 on a full scholarship. He loves to dance. You might have seen him in commercials or music videos. He's performed and taught all over the United States and all over the world in places such as Rome, London, Cuba, Africa, and so on. He's also performed with Savage Jazz Dance Company, you know, Reginald Ray Savage. And he's also taught there as well, jazz dance, that is. He's also performed with Anuba Dance Theater, Sins Invalid, Sonic Dance Theater of Epiphany Productions, Lorraine Hansberry Theater, Alayo Dance Company, which has something coming up. So stay tuned. Cat Willis, Push Dance Company with Risa Simpson and Robert Moses Ken Dance Company. Sign Language Collective, a.k.a. Sign Dance Theater International. He was dance captain for Expedia.com, an Expedia.com commercial. and choreographer for Americana, the musical, and many more. He has attended the California Institute of the Arts and is studying toward a BA at St. Mary's College in of California, LEAP, L-E-A-P. He later, more recently, became the founder and director of Urban Jazz Dance Company in 2007. And Urban Jazz Dance Company, along with Dance Mission, is putting on the second annual Deaf Louder Deaf Dance Festival this weekend, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. He's a faculty member of the East Bay Center for the Performing Arts, Dance Division, Youth in Arts, and Shaw and Anderson Dance Theater, Ross Dance Company. That's just to name a few. And you can visit Antoine at his blog, and you can also visit him at urbanjazzdance.com. However, the blog is a little bit more up-to-date than this particular one, than his website, if you want to get up-to-date information. So I'm going to play a little bit more of Kim Nally. I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. And this is for all of those who look at revolution and liberation struggle as a constant. This is for you.
Thank you so much for coming out tonight.
Well, I wish that I knew how it would feel to be free. Well, I wish that I could break all of the chains that are holding me. Well, I wish that I could say things that I should say. Thank you.
That was Kim Nally. And I want to let you know that while you're listening to the interview with Antoine that I taped a couple of days ago, there are some moments where Antoine has to read my question and comments before he can respond. So that's where the delay is because, you know, as I mentioned earlier, Antoine is deaf. So here is an exciting interview with Antoine Hunter about Deaf Louder, the wonderful Deaf Dance Festival, second annual, this coming weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday at Dance Mission in San Francisco. The performances are Friday and Saturday at 8 and Sunday at 4, and it's going to be a talk at the East Bay Center for the Performing Arts with Michelle Banks. She's coming in from Washington, D.C., and Michelle Banks is phenomenal. She's going to be giving a talk. It's free. And on Sunday, there's going to be dance classes before the performance at 4, and children are especially welcome and invited to come to the dance workshops as well as the performance, which is going to feature young people. And there's going to be poetry, rap, all kinds of wonderful entertainment besides the dance. So it's just going to really be a full experience of a fully accessible program. And Dance Mission is right across the street from the 24th Street BART station, so it's really easy to get to. All righty, so here is Antoine Hunter, part one. So Antoine Hunter, tell us about your second annual festival, dance performances of deaf and hearing impaired artists and choreographers.
Yeah, the Bay Area Deaf Dance Festival, wow, just the second annual. The theme this year is called Deaf Louder. Basically, we're trying to express our culture using art to be louder about the society that we live in and about our experience about being deaf. You know, we have people coming from all over the world, artists that speak different languages, like Buddhist Sign Language, American Sign Language, India Sign Language, and we're sharing our own culture within deaf culture, you know. But this dance festival is not only for deaf, but poet, ASL singer, rapper, comedian, actor, and so many advocates and educators will be coming down. You know, I'm just so excited because we've got London people in L.A., D.C., you know, happening all in Dance Mission Theater, you know, I guess 8 through the 10th.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what's happening.
Okay, well, maybe we'll, like, slow it down a little bit and you can maybe give us some of the details about, you know, specifically some of the people that you're featuring. Are any of the artists ones that were featured in last year's performance, or are they all new?
We have maybe a few that are returning, like James Taylor from Silent Mob is the deaf rapper. He'll be coming back.
Mm.
And we have this one group, Aaliyah Cotton, who is Coda. Herself is not completely deaf, but her parents are deaf.
Mm-hmm.
And Coda is children of a deaf adult, you know. And for the reason I accepted them is because they are a part of deaf culture. They can't help it but to live the life of deaf people, even though they can hear.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just they adopt everything that we have. They're extra sensitive, just as we are as well.
Mm-hmm.
However, they include everything into their life. So they'll be performing. She will be doing like tap dancing and hip hop. So that would be wonderful to see her because she got so inspired from last year to push her show and her dancing up another level. So we do have a few people coming back, but a lot of stars this time are coming. just like Fred Bean, he'll be coming back.
Mm-hmm.
He came in the Bay Area 2011, and he's definitely ready to come back.
Fred is from Washington. Is that the area he's from? Washington D.C.
Yes, he's from Washington D.C.
Mm-hmm.
He is the director of National Deaf Dance Theater at Wild Dapper.
Yeah, and then Joey Antonio, where is he from?
Oh, Joey Antonio, he's from Los Angeles, and he was on MTV, The Best Crew. He was one of the secret weapons to you. Yes, he'll be back doing hip-hop and breakdance. And he's taking this to another level as well.
Mm-hmm. And then Rosa Lee, where is she from?
Rosa Lee, she's all around. She's right now resident in the Bay Area.
Mm-hmm.
She used a lot of videos in theater in Los Angeles, New York. She's very well in the Bay Area, also very advocate for deaf education.
Mm-hmm.
So she's really wonderful. She'll be doing a little acting and dancing as well.
Mhm. Yeah. So is every evening different? August 8th through 10th, like August 8th is a different show from August 9th, or can people see everyone in each night?
Well, August 8th through the 9th, yes, we start at 8 p.m., and that's a little later, so it's not going to be the same program. However, Sunday at 4 p.m. at Family Man Team, I wanted to get the kids involved, so I made it a little bit lighter, and that will be a different program because we have some deaf children dancing with Aaliyah Cotton, and that's going to be definitely fun to see.
Wow. So if people want to see the children, like, for instance, your daughter, does she do ASL and sing? Is that what your daughter, Tonique, is going to be doing, Tonique Hunter?
Well, Tonique Hunter this year, unfortunately, we're going to miss her.
Oh.
She has some big to perform. We're going to definitely miss her. She was trying to make it happen to come out here. But she definitely wanted to send her love because last year was her first big performance to be in a big crowd.
Mm.
You know, she was pregnant and at the time. So she was definitely excited to come. But we won't be able to see her this year, but she sent her love.
Oh, okay. And so where does Tonique live? Where is she living presently?
She's in the Bay Area, the Bay Area, but also she's up North State doing Deaf Camp and trying to be a role model for young children who are deaf as well.
Nice.
So trying to finish up with her summer.
Oh, nice, nice. And then I noticed that that Joy Elaine is going to be performing. Wonderful poet.
Yeah. Yeah. She won third place for Oakland Got Talent. She's definitely magnificent. She will be doing her thing as well. She wrote two new poems.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm excited to see what that is because she's always shocking me.
Nice, nice. And so who are the Coda brothers?
Well, the Coda brothers system is really half and half. And half and half is by Sherry Hicks and Michael Flassi, if I pronounce his name right. Basically, both of them have had many years of performing for deaf audience, and both of them had deaf parents. And a lot of times they had to interpret songs to their families, and the family would always get them to, you know, perform to the family at their first Thanksgiving and Christmas, you know, perform for everybody. And they are magnificent. They have done many shows out through the Bay Area interpreting, not just interpret, but make it more rich and performing. You know, sometimes interpreting shows, it can be very, very plain with interpreters. But with them, they make it so interesting that we can actually hear the music when they interpret. You know what I mean? She doesn't just find they're playing music. No, they're actually imitating the way they sound and as they raise their guitar over their head and wriggling their finger up and down, side to side. It was so full energy, you know, that you cannot be bored and with them and still have entertaining themselves, or not that, but the Dakota.
Wow, wow. So you are so busy yourself traveling, performing throughout the country and in other places. And I was wondering, did you meet these other artists that you have invited to participate in the Urban Jazz Dance and Dance Missions, Deaf Louder, the second Bay Area Deaf Dance Festival? Do you know them because you've met them when you've been traveling? Is that how you've been able to get these wonderful artists to participate in this second annual event?
Well, it's really interesting history because, yes, I do travel a lot, and many of the people that I met were just starting their work. And we inspire each other by, you know, feeding off each other. I've been doing it for quite a long time, started with Stivey Chad Dance Company and Skyline High School. And being many years with them has trained me to be a advanced professional dancer, to work exceedingly, you know, to reaching my dreams and all. Many people believe that I have reached my dream and they wanted to get up there. So as I travel through the state, through the country, many of them said they want to do the same thing that I'm doing, but in their own style, maybe like hip-hop, because I'm more like ballet, jazz, African, you know. But they want to get up there to perform a lot. So a lot of times, it took me 7 years to try to make this happen, even though this is the second annual. 7 years altogether trying to make it happen, to give deaf people what they need, because many theaters sometimes really discriminate deaf to perform. They say sometimes, who will come to a deaf show? Who will? Will the ticket sell? What can we provide them? It will be too complicated to provide them what they need. The lighting? What? How? How do we tell them the cue? Speaker? It's supposed to be out to the audience, not to the performer. You know, where I dance mission, we are very fortunate for them to be willing to work with us, you know, because they're willing to turn the speaker around and make some adjustments for the deaf artist where we can feel the vibration and all. And so I called back all the people from Arizona, London, and everything that finally come to this stage. However, it's really interesting. I love it. Love people to express the way they dance, but we want to make it to the point where it's the best of the best. So during the time before the show, I would spend some time mentoring them for free. You know, for example, Deaf Motion is already here in town from London. They're here. Billy Reed and Cassie is a wonderful hip-hop dancer who has just started performing for 2 years. They're still learning how to bring their dancing to another level. And so they travel all the way out here to get the best of the best, what they say. But I'm still telling them, I'm working on mine, too. But we're trying, you know, the thing is, they're taking a mentorship with me. And so I would attend to the rehearsal, give them feedback and everything. And they love it, and I'm learning from them as well. And it's going to be a rocking show when it performs, you know. But this is how it worked for making this happen. This is how, you know, many people will call me to mentor them, and then I say, you have to perform on this stage, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that's clear. Is that clear?
Yeah. It seems like you're, you know, you have, you're like an elder in the deaf dance community. I mean, you're not old, but you're an elder because you started really young. I mean, you know, you've been doing this professionally since you were in high school, and you are. I mean, you have a real breadth of experience as a performer and also as an activist. And I was wondering, are you still? I know you have some leadership roles in some of the deaf. Organizations, community organizations, and I was wondering, I don't remember the name of the organization. I'm looking through emails to see, but I can't find it just yet. Are you still president of the Bay Area Black Deaf Advocates?
According to National Black Deaf Advocate, I'm still the president of the Bay Area Black Deaf Advocate. And yes, I'm doing a lot. I'm trying to finish up my term.
Mm-hmm.
I have a few more months left.
Okay.
But I'm also just involved with many deaf advocate communities, just like CAD, with California Association of Deaf, and Deaf Hope. Deaf Hope is related to deaf victims who've been raped or abused. We advocate them to support their voice, because a lot of times, sometimes police doesn't believe them, and they just say, oh, that was you because you're deaf, you know. And so we want to make sure their voice is heard and protect our community. So, yeah, I'm still involved in those. I can't pull myself away from the politician area of community, supporting our community. At the same time, I love art to express our love for the people and heal.
Mhm. Yeah. And you are co-founder and former artistic director of the Iron Triangel Urban Ballet.
Oh, Iron Triangle Urban Ballet. Iron Triangle Urban Ballet. Yeah, I really miss them. The young people, I really miss them. Yeah, I just thought, you know, in Richmond that each kid would have their own pre-professional dance company so that they can get ready to be professional. I just feel I was growing up. I missed a lot, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Oakland, we have a lot. But sometimes some of our great teachers leave, so we forget the old tradition sometimes. And I knew that I missed a lot from being deaf, so I wanted to make sure that I get back, you know, make sure they don't miss it. Because I remember seeing people will fold their arm in New York's dance class, and the teacher will throw them out, you know, but I was never taught that here. And so I had to tell them, no, don't fold your arms, you know, because it means that you're better than a teacher or things like that. And those are the forgotten traditions sometimes. You know, we want to give respect to all those who made a path for us, you know. So I love Iron Triangle Urban Ballet from East Bay Center of the Performing Arts. I just really went back to teach there.
Oh, okay.
They're still amazing.
Oh, yeah. Where else are you teaching?
I'm also teaching at Charlie Anderson. That's open to public. I'm mostly teaching at 13 different locations.
13?
You know,
oh, my goodness.
Really, really busy.
Yeah. Wow. 13 different locations. Man, wow, that's amazing. So how are you able to have the Urban Jazz Dance Company, and what are you all doing at the festival next weekend?
How am I able to put that together?
Yeah, my goodness. 13 places? That's more than 7 days. So, like, wow, how do you do that and have a company and prepare for this festival? And also, you know, choreograph new work, because I'm sure you're going to be sharing new work with us, right?
Well, I do have to do some new work, but fortunately, these wonderful studios have been very, very flexible and strict as well to make my art still grow. But not every day I will teach all 13 locations, some on Monday, some on Thursday, you know. And that's just a little bit, no time to eat, right?
You know? Right.
But, yeah, it's been really, really amazing. To really deploy my work. All I can say, I'm really blessed, you know. What they give me, I try to give it back. For example, Deaf Motion from London,
mm-hmm.
you know, they're giving me their talents. They're coming here, learning, and it's an honor to, you know, mentor them. That's given me a lot of blessings. And so within a few weeks, I will go to London with them and continue supporting their work for 10 days and then come right back, you know. While I'm gone, I'll just have to call up a really wonderful local teacher to substitute for me, you know. So just for that 10 days and come back working twice as hard. You know, it's not really easy trying to do what you do, but it could be very overwhelming to the point to say, how did I get here? And will I still have energy tomorrow? I keep looking around and say, who else will do it? You know, I'm just really blessed that my mom has always believed in me, and my Oakland people are still cheering me on. You know, I'm really, really blessed that I keep on thinking the same thing. How do I have time to do all of this? You know, it's a miracle, really, the strength coming from above.
Yeah, that, the piece that, that you did with, Zako, you know, about the brothers who are incarcerated and then, you know, being killed, you know, in prison, you know, by, you know, executed or just, you know, from just being in that sort of a unsafe and inhuman environment. Gosh, that was really powerful as a part of the Black choreographers here and now, and then later on at Zako Studios. What was it called? I forgot the name of it. Something While Black and Brown.
Yeah,
what was the name of that piece?
It was called
Dying While Black and Brown, right?
Yes, it was called Dying While Black and Brown.
Yeah.
Yes, it was about death row, African-American men in death row.
Yeah.
Oh, man, Triana Hugger is really amazing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, her piece was really about, well, the piece of Dying While Black and Brown was really a path to her about the profound wise, because it really took place about the tragedy that happened, you know, in Texas, and how so many people start to realize their freedom, you know what I mean? I love working with Joanna because I keep learning about myself as African-American. And so I was just trying to make sure deaf people don't miss out as well with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did a lot of the deaf community come out, particularly when it moved to San Francisco? Were people able to make it out and see the piece?
For the Wild Dying in Black and Brown?
Yes.
Or
yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, were they able to see you in that piece?
A few people who were part of the deaf community, yes, did come. I did ask Charlie Hugger if she could provide an interpreter, and amazingly, she did without any hesitation.
Mm-hmm.
She was just like, okay, yes, well, of course. She wanted to make sure that the deaf community know what's happening with their own people, because many of us are also brown and black.
Mm-hmm.
So, the few came, but the problem is sometimes deaf people don't know when and where there will be a performance that is deaf friendly.
Mm.
And so it's hard to grab the audience, you know, because sometimes things like this with so much information
mm-hmm.
don't have interpreter or transcript.
Uh-huh.
And Charlie Hugger provided that, so that's wonderful. But many other places, that's why it's hard sometimes to pull people out to new areas, because it could be really painful to pay $30 for the show.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, you could completely miss everything from it. And so that's why my show, the Barrier that Deaf Festival, will be more like a deaf-friendly show, which means what? There will be people who Spanish. There will be equipment where deaf people in the audience can feel the music. There will be an interpreter behind the office box and at the door.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be having a lot more resource for them to feel like, hey, we're coming to a show that fit for them, and they could be a part of the entertainment and not miss anything.
Mm-hmm.
Just, you know, how many times some deaf people go to the movie and everybody laugh, and deaf people say, what was that? You know, they missed it because they can't hear the joke or the sound.
Yeah.
So it's going to be exciting.
Yes, people need to get their tickets quickly, because Dance Mission's not that large, and if, you know, the Bay Area deaf community is not small, people just don't know, because they don't ever see people that are deaf sitting alongside of them. So it's going to be some serious competition for the seats, huh?
Oh, seriously, I just got a call that there's 7 people driving from Los Angeles.
Wow.
Just to watch the show. I'm really moved by that.
Mm.
I'm very moved. It's just so, I was just like, wow, people are flying in and getting rent a car at their own hotel just to watch the show. That agent just killed me. I'm just getting a little bit overwhelmed, because there's amazing people coming, you know, just to see and support the show and maybe grab the talent to take back home with them,
mm-hmm.
you know, because really the purpose for this, is not just to have them perform, but many people have told me through the years that I've been dancing that I was the only deaf dancer. And I was like, no. I'm not the only one.
Mm-hmm.
There's others, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe I'm getting out there a little differently than others, because I'm not ashamed to say that I'm deaf. I'm
mm-hmm.
not ashamed to say I'm African-American. I'm not ashamed to say I'm from Oakland, California. You know, many people say where that is, and I say it's across the bridge from San Francisco. I know San Francisco. I love San Francisco, too, but I'm from Oakland, you know, and I try to stay honest,
mm-hmm.
you know, with what I've been through, because what I've been through is not easy. So it does sometimes take so much where you feel like you're not going to make it, but if you just believe, you will.
Mm-hmm.
you know, right when you get close to the finish line, it feels like, whew, you're out of breath. You got no more, but keep on putting that prayer together and strength together, and you'll make it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a blessing to see all these Deaf Dancers performing coming today with me to be on the finish line and all the people in the audience to cheer us on.
Mm-hmm.
So amazing. I can't wait.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you are extremely visible as a black man and as a deaf artist. People look up and they see you, you know, doing solo performances as well as having your company in work, you know, Art and Soul, you know, you perform there. Trolley Dances, you're one of the sort of the I don't know, one of the almost like the resident artists, because whenever Trolley Dances happens, even that year where you when you lost your hearing aid, the good one, you still performed even though you couldn't hear at all, because you have a little hearing with your hearing aid, but then without the hearing aid,
right,
you have no hearing. I remember that year, and then more recently last year, you were a part of the Bay Area Ethnic Dance Festival, and this was a first for the company, you know, the festival, to have a deaf artist as one of the solo artists. And you're everywhere. So that certainly, I'm sure, is the reason why, you know, there's such impact. But I wanted to go back to your company and ask you again what you have choreographed for this particular show and who's going to to be joining you from your company.
I did some mixed work. I will be having a duet with my company,
mm-hmm.
With Lauren Clay and the avatar is really based on the life experience that I had. It's been a while that I get to really show what I'm really doing. The title, it hasn't been really made yet because I'm still trying to figure it out. We're pretty much done with the movement, but having the title, wow, as you just talked about my life, you know, I don't know what to call it yet because it has so much in it. As you said, I've been everywhere. Each different timeline, I was somewhere else, but yet still a black man who is deaf from the Bay Area. And so I'm still figuring out the title for that. But it's related to the life experience that I have.
Mm-hmm.
So one solo that I am doing have been choreographed by 5 different choreographers. My goal was to get 12 different choreographers, but I got 5 because everyone's busy. But and popular for example, Alan Chan, who is an Icon writer and avid speaker, and she owned a restaurant in Oakland called The Few Bar. She's amazing in the Bay Area. And she choreographed it one dance, 1 minute, on me. And it was very, very beautiful. Old Dave from Yuma Brainer, he choreographed it 1 minute, a little bit of an Irish dance in it. Aaliyah, who did belly dancing with me, 1 minute of the belly dance, and Alpha Haiti from Sean Roberts. So we have 5 choreographers putting 1 minute on me. The purpose of that is to get them to say what it is to work with a deaf dancer. You know, Nia Halstead, wow. I've never worked with a deaf dancer, and it was really pleasant for her because she was able to see how she has to push herself in another box to connect with a deaf dancer. She has to actually turn herself to me, where maybe she's so used to turning away from dancers and moving around. These are professional, wonderful, over 30 years, 15 years choreographers. And yeah, the experience for them can be a little nervous and new. And so that's why I asked them to choreograph 1 minute, because I guess I'm crazy enough to do it, you know, because they were doing things I'd never done before, rolling on the floor, belly dancing. I mean, whoa, I have big respect for belly dancing now, because that muscle work for maximum, it burns. It burned really bad. You know? So it's like, wow. You know? Wow. So that solo is called I Hear, I Teach. And all the choreographers write their note on Dance Mission Wall to say how they felt when they choreographed and what they learned. And so my hope with that is that it will give the courage to other choreographers, because there's some amazing dancers out there, and big choreographers sometimes get really nervous to work with deaf people.
Interesting. Wow. It's really something how, as an artist, you're also a teacher, you know. You can't just think about the art, because even if you just think about the art, there's always a learning curve happening, because you live in a world where it's majority hearing, not majority deaf. So just your being in the world means that as you're moving through the hearing world as a deaf man, there's a learning curve happening, particularly when people really notice, you know, that you have a hearing aid on, and that they can't turn away, otherwise you don't know what they're saying. and that you're speaking, you know, for our convenience, not for your own, because you can't hear us if we speak back. You have to read our lips. So it's just really, you know, I just think it's just really admirable that you work so hard to communicate.
Thank you. I don't know. I think what it is was I grew up segregated from the hearing community and from the deaf community, too, because hearing people didn't accept me because I couldn't hear, and deaf people didn't accept me not because I could hear just a little bit of the hearing aid, but because I wanted to get outside of the box. You know, for example, being basketball, I wanted to go ahead and be on the basketball team in our school at Bernhardt Elementary School. And some of the deaf people would be like, whoa, no, don't join that. They're all hearing. Deaf people don't play basketball with hearing. And I was like, I wanted to get outside the box. So I wasn't one of them, because I wanted to do something different with my life. You know, I wanted to bring people together. It was so segregated, such a war. Only guess what? They both want the same thing, but they have a different way of saying it, and they just don't know each other's language, you know? And so I'm just like, wow. They want the same thing. They're angry about the same thing in America, but the only reason to get a little bit messed up is because they don't understand each other. So I want to have everybody together, because my parents are hearing and I'm deaf. I don't want to be segregated from hearing people. You know what I mean? So I bring everybody together, and I hope that, you know, the world gets a little bit better, just a little bit, you know, just a little bit.
Yeah, so, wow, so now you're a parent, too, and and your children and your children are hearing, right? And so, wow, that's really yeah. Sort of carrying forth these lessons. And I was wondering, did you end up playing basketball at Bret Hart?
Yeah, that's just real. Yeah, I was a basketball player from there. I wasn't really good at first. It took me a really long time. You know, I thought Michael Jordan and Earl Jordan were two different persons. So that's how bad I was, you know. But at the end, I got pretty good. I had some proud moments, you know. But it was really challenging because my coach did no time into it, you know. I mean, and I just had to do my best to read everybody's love, you know. But I don't regret the hard work, you know. I don't regret that I didn't stay in that group where they said I shouldn't be on the basketball team, you know, because I learned so much from my coach and, you know, Coach Smith from Bret Hart Elementary said, okay, you're on the team. And it wasn't like he just kept me on the bench. He let me play. And it only motivated me to continue to make mistakes and get better at it, you know. I'm really grateful for them for letting me have the opportunity because he was the one that said, you need to put on deodorant and work harder, you know. But he told me the truth, that someone didn't have the gut to tell me, you know, deodorant? Oh, I didn't even know that, you know, because I'm just a kid. And to work harder. Wow, okay. Rather than saying nothing and just put me on the bench. So I'm really, really grateful for him, Coach Smith, man. Wow. You know.
Yeah. And then, you know, having parents that would allow you to live outside of the constraints of either community, the hearing or the deaf community, and let you be your own person. Yeah, I want you to speak about that and then sort of parlay that into your own sort of parenting philosophy.
Ooh, well, I think my mom, you know, she's an amazing Christian woman, a single mom, and she raised three of us, two of my sisters, all of her own, and adopted my brother, Isis. We were very artistic family, you know. My mother viewed me as a pioneer, a person who cuts the path for others. And, you know, I would go blindly to the unknown and make it to something easy for other people to walk a little bit better or through, you know. It won't be easier, maybe, but a little bit easier to see, you know what I mean? She's always believed in that, and she had named me Antoine. That means conqueror, and the best day, that means overcomer, and she let me know in advance at that time what my name means, and it had carried me through my whole life. And she viewed my hearing aid at the time like her glasses. She saw groups of families crying about their children being deaf, and they would ask her how she felt about me being deaf. She took off her glasses and said, I can't see. And she put it back on and said, now I can see. And that's what it is with his hearing aid. And he can't hear without it. He can hear a little bit with it. And it makes him no different from the rest of us. he will be able to drive and have children and have a career. Because he's the overcomer. And she continued to cheer me on. She was, I could tell you, I wore my mom a little bit out because I kept on changing my, what I'm going to go after. I was the track and field up. I was going to be an NBA basketball player, a bodybuilder, and everything. And finally, at the end, you know, danced the choreographer as it is. And she just continued to try to provide everything I need, you know. Because it's not easy when they keep on changing. Bodybuilding? What? Okay, here's a bodybuilding magazine. Here's some weight. You know, oh, wow, now you want to be a dancer. Let's go find ballet shoes and stuff like that. But mom, oh, my gosh, she's just been really patient with me, you know. And, you know, she just put me in a prison like some of my other deaf friends. That were their parents would put them in a box, would never let them go out for the weekend and stuff like that. But she didn't do that with me. I think one thing is that she believed that I would be great. And I followed that for my child, my daughter. My daughter is Doula Hunter. I named her as well. And Doula means brilliant. And she's reading. She's fine. She talks like she's seven. And she's only three.
Oh, really?
You know, the other day, we were eating pancakes and waffle. And she said Baba, which it means father in Africa. African language. She said, Baba, how's your pancake? And I said, it's good. And I said, how's yours? And she said, mine's a little dry, but I'm thankful. You know, and I was like, oh, wow, what a really cool conversation coming from her, you know. But she really is brilliant. Right, you know, and I think our name carries us through the rest of our lives to help us understand who we are if we give them that what we believe they'll be, it will be, you know what I mean? It's just for me, I think it's because it can carry me through the rest of my life. I have noticed some people try to find out who they are, and I did try to find out who I am, but that name has told me for the rest of my life, no matter what I will do in my life, I will always overcome. So for Doula, no matter what it seems and how many times she fails, as a beautiful woman she will be brilliant. You know what I mean? Can you believe she speaks a little Spanish or sign language when she's only three?
Wow, yeah, that's pretty phenomenal. But then look at her father, right?
Oh, well. She corrected me the other day, talking about Baba. First position is a little bit more turned out. So her turned out was better than mine. So I was like, wow.
Oh, wow, that is something.
That's not how you do it. So that's great because she's going to be better than me. So I guess that's what the way it should be.
Yeah. So I noticed, you know, coming back to the Bay Area Deaf Dance Festival, that you're going to actually be having a workshop with Michelle Banks. Why don't you tell us about that? It's going to be at the East Bay Center for the Performing Arts, I believe. I Am Every Woman, Women Empowerment Workshop. For all younger and older women, it says August 9th, 3 p.m. at the East Bay Center for Performing Arts. Antoine Hunter to all deaf community advocates. Yeah, it's a part of your, is that still happening? I'm on your website now.
Yes, it's definitely still happening.
Okay.
Yes,
it's definitely happening. August 9th or 3 p.m. at East Bay Center Performing Arts. Basically, Michelle Banks is just a great deaf icon, but she definitely represents African American community and women. You know, excuse me, I'm a feminist. I cannot help it. I grew up with five women in the house, and I cannot stand how sometimes people have treated our sisters, our mothers, you know, and now our daughters, our children. So I am always really motivated by, you know, women leaders, you know, and they have inspired me. My mother has inspired me, you know, Debbie Allen has inspired me. You know, a lot of wonderful African American women, you know, and Michelle Banks has been through a lot as a deaf black woman. So she'll be sharing some of her life experience, and she will be giving a women empowerment speech and saying, we cannot look at ourselves as lower and dehumanize ourselves. You know what I mean? Even though we are deaf, we may not speak as clearly as others, but we definitely can speak louder using many things, technology, art, the people that surround us, you know, and not give up. Right now, the woman from London has shared the experience about people in India sometimes really disrespect Indian women. And so she's definitely looking forward to go to the workshop. She's a part of Deaf Motion. And she really wanted to learn a lot from her so she could continue her speech and supporting women in India, because there's a lot of abuse to women in India. And I'm very shocked to hear some of the things that she has shared with me, and I'm very blessed to be able to give the workshop in our community. So she's coming off from Washington, D.C. She opened up a deaf theater, and wow, many people have told her the same thing. Don't do it. But she said, I will do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Her theater is the Onyx Theater Company, and it presents works of that merge sign language and spoken English, which is really similar to what you do in your theater. Because a lot of times you also bring in film, and you invite the audience to participate in the world of the deaf and hearing impaired audiences, and you know, and see how that feels, you know, where, you know, all of a sudden you don't know what's going on. And it's just really great the way you sort of shift the focus in your pieces so that everyone gets a different perspective, literally within the performance itself. Like, we get a chance to play different roles and come out understanding, you know, other a little bit better than we did before. So now other is not other, other is ourselves, because we have a new understanding of what it means, you know, to be a part of community that has, you know, differences that are not insurmountable. So that's just really wonderful, and she does that quite a bit, you know, in her work. And I think, didn't we, when we went to Pacific Film Archive, when they were celebrating sort of black films that came out of UCLA during the Black Power movement, she was the star in one of the films. Is that the film? Is she the one that we went to see?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. That was her. She was playing an African woman with AIDS as well, who was trying to live her life, you know. And, wow, she's been doing this quite a long time. I try to learn as much as I can from her. I'm really excited to see what she's going to be presenting on her lecture, you know, because I continue to learn so much from her. She's also still teaching at Washington, D.C., MSSD, which is right up the hill from Gallaudet University or their school in Washington, D.C. And so, I just can't wait to see what she's going to present.
Michelle Banks is big time. The film that we saw is called Compensation. It's by Zainabu Irene Davis, and Michelle, she's done a whole lot. She's been in a lot of films. She's performed A Not So Quiet Nocturne, which stars Michelle is a pregnant woman who contracts HIV virus from her husband. And she has other credits, which include A Free Bird of a Cutting Edge by Anne-Marie Bryan, Malcolm X by Spike Lee. We already mentioned Compensation by Zainabu Irene Davis. Her theatrical credits include For Color Girls Who Consider Suicide, When the Rainbow is Enough by Indashaki Shange. And she's worked as an interpreter, director with ASL Interpreters on plays like House Arrest by Anna Deavere Smith. Anna Deavere Smith was just out here recently at Berkeley Rep. Bringing the Noise, Bringing the Funk, and the Life. She's been featured in magazines like Essence, Gallaudet, Today, The World Around You, and currently you mentioned that she's a drama teacher at JHS 47 School for the Deaf in Manhattan. So it's great that you're able to get Michelle. Like, where did you get all this money to bring all these people here from London and Washington and Southern California and the Bay Area? Like, you must have been fundraising, like, forever. This sounds expensive.
Well, that's why I talk about the money part. But, I to be honest, a lot did come out of my pocket for bringing her out here, but it's totally worth it. Somebody has to do it. We have to share what she's doing. It's really, really awesome. So all the things she's doing for our community. However, I'm a little upset that not a lot of people know who she is. You know what I mean? She is a part of Black history, and Black history needs to use her a lot, a lot more than before. So, I want to see her more. I really love seeing her on Girlfriend from UPN, but I would love to see her more because Mertie Mallon, the Deaf actress, she's amazing, but Michelle Banks, representing Black community and Deaf community, should be used more as well, But also, I do need to say that for the Bay Area Deaf Dance Festival, I really burned my pocket last year, so I'm really grateful for Dalabak Family Foundation to help out a little bit with the funding. And the Bay Area Theater grant, cash grant, to help out, as well. I'm so grateful for them to help put some more lighting for us, get the equipment and food that we need for the artists, and get them into the hotel because, they deserve it. We got people coming from all over USA trying to use art to tell what deaf needs, what deaf is, and that deaf is here,
So let our audience know we're speaking to Antoine Hunter, artistic director and founder of the Bay Area Deaf Dance Festival, which is happening August 8th through 10th at Dance Mission, Friday, August 8th, and Saturday, August 9th at 8 o'clock in the evening, and Sunday, August 10th at 4 p.m., and The two evening shows are the same, but the Sunday show is going to be really fun with some young folks performing, so you need to make a weekend of it. And tickets are $25, and you can get them at Brown Paper Tickets. And, yeah, it's going to really be really fun, Antoine. This just sounds so fabulous. I remember when you were thinking about this a long time ago, like, I don't know, it's been, you've been having this desire to do this for a long time, and just trying to figure out where am I going to do it at? Because I remember we've had conversations about it in the past, and now here you are on number two. And, you know, what would be really great is to be able to take it on the road, because everyone can't necessarily get here from Well, it seems as if the last part of the interview was cut off. I don't know what happened. So I want to let people know that you can see Antoine and participate in the second annual Deaf Louder Deaf Dance Festival at Dance Mission this weekend. It's going to be really exciting. There are a lot of extras, so definitely want to not miss this. It was really fabulous last year, and it's going to be even better this year. And I want to tell you that the event, the Jazz Jam, is tonight, Wednesday. Paul Tillman Smith is hosting the jam, the Jazz Jam session at the Kingston 2 Restaurant Bar and Bar in Oakland from 7 to 10 p.m. His quartet, Paul's quartet, is featuring Robert Stewart on tenor sax. And the address for Kingston 2 Restaurant and Bar is 2270 Telegraph Avenue. And the phone number is 510-846-4322. 510-846-4322. And, yeah, you don't want to miss it. It's going to be fabulous. all righty. And Damu Sudi Ali is going to be hosting the Sunday Jam, and that's at the Southern Cafe Soul Food Buffet, and that's at 2000 MacArthur Boulevard in Oakland from 5 to 8. So it's early evening. And tonight from 7 to 10. So the music is free. And so you should get on down and enjoy some wonderful music and some good food. Support live music. So, yeah, thank you so much for tuning in for another edition of Wanda's Picks. And look forward to seeing you at one of these events. Definitely this weekend at Deaf Louder, I'm going to make one of the evenings. I'm looking at Saturday, but maybe I might try to get to Friday. So take good care, and thanks for joining us. Peace and blessings.